This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So I want to talk a bit about the Rebel Eight. And Rebel Eight was sort of co-founded by a couple of friends of mine, Mike and Josh. And years ago, Mike, I asked him, what does it mean? And he told me it meant the rebellion of the Eightfold Path. And then years later, actually just maybe a year or so ago, I asked Josh, I said, you know, the rebellion of the Eightfold Path, like that's, he said, oh no, that's not what it means. He said it means, he said he came up with it in his, when he came up with it, it meant like revelation. Rebel Eight and a revelation. And so actually I like both of these, and I'm going to give a little bit of a talk about rebellion and revelation, because it fits perfectly, of course, with Against the Stream and what the Buddha talked about as what we can do, what we are doing, and what the path to awakening is, that it's a rebellion against the norm that leads to the truth being revealed. There's a revelation, and I like this perspective of revelation, although it seems so biblical, right? But what it really means is that there's something here that's revealed. It reveals itself, and that what we're really looking for has always been here. It was hidden. Something that was hidden is revealed. Some inner goodness, some knowing, some awakening, some what we would traditionally, in some Buddhist traditions, call Buddha nature, is that it's actually human nature, that Buddhism is a humanist tradition that says everything that you're seeking is already here. All of the happiness, all of the freedom, all of the compassion, all of the love that we've been looking outside of ourselves for is part of our true nature, is revealed through this process of turning towards our pain rather than away from it. Turning towards pleasure and understanding that it's impermanent rather than clinging to it, accepting the impermanent nature. When the Buddha came to his awakening, his nirvana enlightenment, the end of suffering, through mindfulness practice, and he had learned the concentration avoidance techniques, and he had seen, oh, these get me really temporarily elated, blissful, temporarily free from suffering, but when I'm not concentrated, the causes of suffering, the clinging, the aversion, just returns. Concentration doesn't transform. It just allows us to focus deeply and ignore deeply. But he said, when I discovered mindfulness and started turning towards my pain, seeing the impermanent nature of it, seeing that so much of our pain is impersonal, so then I learned to meet it with compassion. Then, and there was almost a natural way that he talked about that the compassion was revealed, that it was always here, but we didn't have access to it. But by turning towards our pain, there was something in our heart and our mind and our being that actually naturally learned to care about our own pain. And so that was his experience and his teaching and his what we're all trying to do. And after awakening, he wasn't quite sure what to do because he said, this was so radical what I did, turning towards my pain, not avoiding it. Paying attention without trying to manipulate my experience and just letting my mind be my mind and just letting my heart and my emotions and my sensations and just looking at my experience, investigating it. He said, this is so radical, I don't think people will do it. I'm asking for something that's so counterintuitive, and I did something that was so counterintuitive. And he referred to it as patiso tagami. He said, I went against the norm, against the stream. And through going against the norm, I came to happiness. I came to freedom. I came to a state of not suffering. Now, I think it's really always important for us to remember and for me to remind us that not suffering does not mean no pain. And that we have to have a definition, a distinction between pain and suffering. And when the Buddha says nirvana in this lifetime, that we can come to a place of not suffering, it's that we don't suffer about being in pain. It's not that we're no longer in pain. It's that we're no longer meeting pain with hatred. That we begin to meet pain with compassion. But pain continues. If you have a nervous system, if you're alive, if you're breathing, you're going to have unpleasant thoughts and feelings and sensations. Suffering is when we hate those, when we resist them. Suffering is also when we cling to pleasure, because it's impermanent and we get attached to impermanent experiences. We're born into this experience of repetitive craving for life to be pleasant, for our experience to be enjoyable. And it's just not pleasant often enough to sustain or to fulfill those cravings. And we cling and we try to keep and we try to control and manipulate. So the Buddha said, I came to this awakening that went against the stream. And so the whole path he's talking about as a path of rebellion. Rebelling against the norm. And he said, the first thing, reminder to most of us, is turning towards our suffering. Looking at it, the first noble truth. Acknowledging, yes, I have been suffering. Yes, there is suffering in life. Yes, I'm not absolutely happy all of the time. I have dissatisfaction, I have stress, I have grief, I have all kinds of unpleasant experiences that I'm not meeting with compassion, that I'm taking very personally, and that I'm creating layers and layers of suffering on top of. And then looking at the second noble truth, really investigating, turning towards, why is this? Could I be more free? Could I be more happy? What's the cause? Second noble truth. Seeing clearly that the cause of all human unhappiness is a repetitive craving that is not your fault. It's not a moral issue. It's not sin. It's just biology. It's just that we are born into this body that is the product of millions of years of human evolution, and that although we've evolved these big human neocortex brains, we're still mostly ruled by a reptilian brain that has craving and aversion as its set point. And that someone said most of what the neocortex human brain does is rationalize the cravings and aversions of the brain stem, create philosophies and religions and all kinds of ideas around why is it like this? Why is there all this craving and aversion? And some call it sin, and some call it sin. And some call it human nature. Some call it animal instinct. Some understand that we are animals. And then the third noble truth, where the Buddha says, I've come to the end of suffering through my own efforts, and this is possible for everyone. Anybody who is willing to turn towards, who is desperate enough to turn towards, who is dissatisfied enough with what the normal human condition leads to, and is willing to meditate, and is willing to be honest and ethical and kind and generous. Anybody who's willing to apply these practices can come to the end of suffering. Now, maybe the end of suffering is a little high bar for some of us. But certainly decreasing and decreasing and decreasing the amount of suffering. I'm not so interested in full enlightenment as that. You know, so maybe some of you feel like, yes, full enlightenment. You know, 20 years ago, I was like, I'm getting enlightened first. Thought it was an extreme sport meditation. I'm going to win. And then after meditating for almost 30 years now, I'm like, well, I suffer so much less than I used to, and that's totally good enough. I don't know if I'm getting enlightened anytime soon, but the ability to meet my own pain with compassion, I feel so grateful for. And it's something that God developed slowly over the years. In order to get to this place of freedom, whatever level of freedom we attain in this lifetime, whether that's the end of the path, nirvana, liberation, or it's a lot of progress, a lot of decreasing in suffering, it is all lined out in the rebellion of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path can be broken down into three sections: wisdom, ethics, and meditation. Now, for most of us in the West, and certainly in our tradition, it's meditation that we start with, and mindfulness and concentration. And I know I talk a bit of shit about concentration. And I say, you know, it doesn't work. I stand behind it that it doesn't work by itself. But that actually concentration is very useful when combined with mindfulness. If we can learn to focus, if we can learn to concentrate, and we can bring that skill to mindfulness, then you have deep, penetrating insight into the impermanent, into the impersonal, the unsatisfactory nature of things. This is the definition of insight or vipassana meditation, seeing clearly. You have to have some level of concentration. The mindfulness without concentration is too scattered. But so concentration and mindfulness become partnered as part of our meditative discipline. Ethics. In honesty, in integrity, in how we speak and how we behave and how we relate to money, how we relate to sexuality, how we I love that there's so much emphasis on relationship, and that really what Buddhism is teaching is a relational path. It's not a avoidant, it's not a escapist, it's not a go hide in a cave. It's about how we speak to each other. It's about how we listen to each other. It's about how we relate to our own mind, how we speak to ourselves. And the Buddha brought into the Eightfold Path renunciation. That we don't get to just do whatever, we don't get to just follow our drives. Following our drives, our cravings, is going to create suffering. That there's a level of renunciation necessary. But not such a puritanical or judgmental or level of renunciation. I mean, I would say that the core renunciation that Buddhism asks for is renouncing attachment and renouncing greed, hatred, and delusion. But within that, in the precepts that the Buddha talks about avoiding sexual misconduct and really looking at our craving and our sex drive and the beauty of love and intimacy and the pleasure of sexuality and how addictive that can become and how it can fuel us into sometimes being unethical or dishonest or causing harm some way to ourselves or others. And to bring into our mindfulness practice sexuality. Not setting it aside as like that's not spiritual, but making part of our spiritual practice our relationship to our sexuality, embracing it, turning towards it, investigating it. And then having the willingness to say, but at times we will renounce. It won't be the appropriate person to flirt with or sleep with, or and that even though there's a desire there, that you have renunciation around it. You avoid sexual misconduct. And, you know, one of the controversial tenets of ethics in Buddhism is that the Buddha said, if you're serious about being mindful, if you really want to be awake, there's not really a place for recreational drug and alcohol use. Because as soon as you start using drugs and alcohol, you can't fully be mindful anymore. And so that glass of wine blocks your ability to be fully mindful, to be fully choosing. That bong hit, that LSD, that whatever it is. Then mindfulness is not a choice anymore. You lose the ability. Now this is controversial, and people think like, hey, I'm not an alcoholic, why do I have to be sober? Sobriety is for alcoholics. I just want to meditate. Now there isn't a have to here, but I also feel like this is part of the rebellion. Drugs and alcohol use and the pleasure that provides for so many people has become so normalized. And people even, like, you feel left out if you don't drink. Like, you go somewhere and everybody's drinking and you're like, well, I'm practicing Buddhism, so I don't drink. Or I'm in recovery, so I don't drink. And you feel like, and that's a form of rebellion. You're saying, yeah, I don't fit in. I don't do what everyone else does. I don't put myself to sleep for fun. I choose to stay awake. I don't numb out my feelings and create artificial pleasure in my life. I choose to stay awake even if it's boring, even if it's uncomfortable, even if I'm a little bit separate from everyone else in the room who's having champagne at the wedding. I choose to abstain, and this is the Buddha's core encouragement. Now, as a recovering person, and probably half of you are in recovery and half of you aren't, recovery from addiction. Usually our room is mixed, about 50-50, recovering people and not recovering people. I feel like for the recovering people that get involved in Buddhism, it's so supportive. It's like, okay, cool, I need to not do that anyway, and I have this path and this, it's important, it's supportive. I feel for all of the, what we call normies, in the room who aren't addicts, aren't alcoholics, and totally want to enjoy a breakfast bong hit. And of course it's choice, and although I am 100% convinced that the Buddha's teaching was abstinence, renunciation, a lot of my teachers don't follow the fifth precept. A lot of Buddhists don't practice total abstinence. It's not that meditation doesn't work at all. It's not that you're not going to make any progress if you drink wine sometimes or something. And so it becomes a very personal choice for those who can have balance with drugs and alcohol, whether they choose to or not. Or they choose to say, I'm going to actually really go for this mindful life. That doesn't really have much of a place for drugs and alcohol and mindfulness. Total personal choice. So through committing to an ethical way of being, again, honesty and integrity and inclusive of our relationships to sexuality, our relationship to money, that our whole life becomes an opportunity for being awake, for seeing clearly and responding appropriately. It's not just what we're doing on the meditation cushion. Actually, the meditation cushion is probably, it's maybe the most important on some level, because it's the training that gives us the insights and the understanding. It's so key to have a meditation practice. But we take the wisdom that we develop in the meditation and we apply it throughout the rest of the day, right? How, you know, even really committed meditators maybe only sit for 1 or 2 hours a day, but then they have the other 15 hours of not doing formal practice to apply this, and how we speak and how we listen and how we treat each other and how we drive down the freeway, how we show up in the supermarket, how we show up at home, how we talk to our children, how we talk to our partners, how we connect. And again, my sense, my understanding is that through this process, we're not creating some sort of new wisdom. That we're uncovering something that was dormant, that was buried, that we didn't have access to. That we can think of mindfulness, we can think of the forgiveness practice, the compassion practice, the loving kindness practice, all of the tools that we're given, the renunciation. We can think of all of this as like a shovel where we are excavating. We are uncovering our Buddha nature. We're uncovering something that has always been here, and that it gets revealed. And that it is, in this way, a revelation to each individual, this process of awakening that we're in. That the rebellion of the practice leads to revealing what is true. And it's not Buddhist truth. This is what is true, I believe, for everyone that looks closely at their own mind. Whether they have a Buddhist map or a non-Buddhist map, through introspection, if you look at the human condition, you will see everything's impermanent. You will see attachment causes suffering. You will see aversion causes suffering. You will see compassion ends suffering. So these are some of my thoughts about the rebellion of the Eightfold Path and the revelations that it leads to. And I have some time for questions. Any thoughts from you? You know, when you were, I was reminded of talking about this process where sometimes we're so confident and we're so on the path, and that somehow we kind of lose the path back into a thinking there's a material solution or the relationship. I don't need to meditate anymore. I'm in a, you know, or whatever it is, work. Something takes priority over our practice. And it's a pretty natural cycle for many people. I was reminded in my early practice, I think I got this from my father, and it was this piece of paper, supposedly a quote from the Buddha, although I don't know where in the Buddhist teachings it is, and it just said, it doesn't matter how long it has been since you've forgotten, only how soon you remember. Because sometimes when we've forgotten, then we can beat ourselves up, like, why did I do that? And so just coming right back into the present moment and saying, now I remember, I'm back. Here I am. It's like when you're meditating and your mind wanders and you're in some fantasy, and then you come back to the breath. So sometimes that's like a 5-year detour, and then you come back to the practice. And you say, okay, this is what matters. I'm back. I'm remembering what's important to me. I'm recommitting to my practice, to what I truly believe will bring about some happiness, some satisfaction. Facebook didn't work. I surrender. And so now I'm going to come back to my practice and bring this mindfulness to my relationship to social media or whatever. So welcome back. So in the third foundation of mindfulness, the encouragement is to turn towards your mind with a quality of observing it, right? And so you're not always just yanking your attention back to your breath by ignoring what's in the mind, but you're saying, okay, let me turn towards, like, what's happening? And by mind, it's this word citta, which means both the heart and the mind, so the emotions and the stories. But observing them and saying, like, okay, my mind is filled with grief. Let me observe that. Let me be present with that grief. And there's a story about it, but there's a choice with a level of concentration and a level of mindfulness to be observing it and receiving it and being with it and tending to that grief or that craving or that resentment or whatever it is that has arisen, where you're not so identified with it and you're not so much in it and in the resentment and kind of feeding it, but you're tending to it, you're relating to it. And so that's encouraged in meditation. When that arises, you're not trying to stop the thought. You're saying, like, oh, look at this memory. Oh, this memory. But it's so easy. Like, I think the image that works for me is that often those thoughts are like a bubble. And you can either be observing the resentment bubble, or you can be in it, floating off with it, feeding it. You know what I mean? Like, oh, resentment has arisen. This is calling for some forgiveness. Or, yeah, fuck those guys. Right? Like, really in the resentment. Rather than, oh, I need to send some forgiveness to myself and some compassion and, you know, like, really tending to it. So meditation isn't always a sense of, like, ignoring it and come back to the present. Because that's happening right now in the present. Resentment has arisen. Fear has arisen. Lust, craving, clinging. It's happening right now. Even if it's a memory. It's a memory that's arising right now. Even if it's a plan. It's a plan that's in the mind right now. So it's present time awareness. But it's the difference between being with it and being in it and being taken off into the future, into the planning, into the... Does that make sense? That is where we're going. It's hard to do before you have an established ability to concentrate, to know that you're here, and to be mindful of what's happening. Because often when we turn our attention towards our mind, we just float off with it. And it's where, you know, an ability to focus with the breath, with the body, leads to that ability to observe the mind in that way. It sounds to me like a pretty natural process. I think for most of us, we sit down to meditate in the beginning and we feel a breath or two, or and then we're gone for a while and we're like, oh shit, I'm thinking, and we come back and we feel a breath or two and then we're gone for a little while and then we come back. Like you're saying, that coming and we connect and then we're identified and then we come back, and that's just the process. And then you find, oh, actually now I'm with like 10 breaths before I get drawn off, and then I come back and now I'm with, I was actually present for like 20 breaths before I got lost. And that the time that we stay increases, and the time that we're wandering in thought, like identified with thought, not just observing, but actually lost in thought, it starts to get smaller and smaller. And maybe eventually we get to a place where we're here for the whole half hour, the whole 45 minutes. Now, it doesn't mean that no thoughts arise, but it means that we don't feed them into the place where we're gone. We just know thoughts are arising and passing the bubbles. You're watching the show, but you know you're here the whole time. You're grounded, you're present. And that feels like a natural process of progression that happens the more we get concentrated and the more we get used to what I'm doing here is observing, not thinking about my experience, but observing it with the mind. But it's so tricky, right? Because you're watching the mind with the mind. And sometimes your mind says, you're not thinking about anything right now. You're like, wait, that's a thought. Yeah. You start patting yourself on the back during meditation. Doing pretty good at this shit. Which is okay if you're kind of just with, oh yeah, now my mind is complimenting me. Or it's judging me, or it's comparing, or whatever it's doing, but you're with. That's just what the mind does. You're not taking it so personal. Some of this is that level of insight into anatta, into not self, and that it's not so personal what the mind does. It's not all your fault. It's not. One of the experiences that I had led me, that was so helpful in meditation, is that I really thought that thought that maybe eventually I could control my mind. And then I started to reflect on, oh, the mind is a bit like the lungs or the heart. When you look at this the human condition, the lungs just like breathe all by themselves. You're not breathing. Your body is breathing you. You're not making your heart beat. Your heart is just beating itself. But like the lungs, you can have some influence. Oh, I can choose to take really deep breaths or shallow breaths. I can hold my breath for however long, 30 seconds or a minute or something. Or I have some influence over my breath, but I can't control it all of the time. I have some influence over my mind. I can choose to reflect and plan and analyze, but my mind does whatever it wants, even when I don't want it to. I don't get to control it. It keeps thinking, just like the lungs keep breathing. And so that shift to, I have influence over the mind rather than absolute control over it. I have influence over my lungs rather than absolute control over them. It really shifts things for you when you know that, not as an intellectual idea, but you really see that clearly through your own meditation. Thinking isn't a problem anymore. It's like that that book, Thoughts Without a Thinker, Epstein. You start to really realize there's thoughts, but there's no thinker here. There's just thoughts and awareness. Sometimes there's a bit of a setup that eventually will become fearless. But fear is actually a very healthy and necessary instinct. And did you guys hear the question of like, okay, there's that, maybe I would call neurotic fear or anxiety that's, there's actually no reason. No good, you know, like there's some old trauma in my body and memories that are creating this. And that's a good reason, but it's actually in this moment I'm safe. There's no imminent threat. But when there is an imminent threat, you're not going to get to the place where you don't have any fear of that. Like, that's not useful to get to the place where you're not afraid of getting hit by a car in the street. That's actually a healthy fear, a necessary instinct. But that thing that you're talking about is, how do I know? When should I have some healthy concern, fear, anxiousness around, like, is this a safe environment? And when is it maybe neurotic or unnecessary? So I don't have the answer, but I think it's the right question, and it's knowing that maybe there's a propensity towards some anxiousness that probably a lot of the time you can err on the side of, I'm probably safe, rather than I'm probably unsafe. And then I think that I actually land a little bit on the other side of things, where I have a little bit too much like, I'm probably safe, and I might not be at all. Like, it's probably safe to split lanes on my motorcycle at 100. You know, like a lack of healthy fear, which isn't good either. Right? That's the other side. That's like my kind of suicidal shadow of like, this is not safe at all, but it's fun. Rather than, you know, so, but we all have to find our balance. We all have to look at that and look at that a lot of these human emotions are impersonal, like you started the question with. Necessary, natural, normal. But sometimes our life experience puts us in the place where it's either over intensified or it's actually not accessed in a healthy way. I don't know how much more I have to say other than I think that it's the process that we're all looking at. What's the balanced relationship to fear? What's the balanced relationship to anxious? Is this in the investigation without trying to figure it all out, but continuing to look at it and turn towards it? And when you sort of know your patterns, then you can start to compensate for them. I'm probably safe. in this situation. Cool. So happy to be with you all tonight. Thank you for listening. And I don't always remember to say this, but I like to say that I really feel like it's in the spirit of Buddhism to remind everybody that these kind of teachings, and that Buddhism isn't about belief, isn't about faith, isn't about agreeing, but that all of this perspective is for your investigation. And that ultimately each one of us is responsible for our own happiness and is responsible for our own knowing. And that if the teachings resonate, then, you know, trust that and investigate it. And if some of the teachings don't resonate, then investigate it. The Buddha said, you know, don't believe in things because they're tradition, because they're religion, because your friends or family believe in them. But look at them directly for yourself and say, when I'm mindful, do I suffer less? When I develop compassion, you know, like, is it practical? Does it work in your own life? In order to know that, you have to really apply it for a little while to really give it a shot and say, does this really work? And then come to your own knowing. It's said that the Buddha would end almost all of his lectures with a simple phrase, it is now time for you to do as you see fit, rather than believe me, follow me, any of that stuff. He would just say, like, here's the Dharma, here's what I know to be true. You have to find out what's true for yourself. It's time for you to do as you see fit. I tell you, stop drinking. You can decide whether you stop drinking or not. It's time for you to do as you see fit. I want to thank Josh and his crew that's over there in the back from Rebel 8 for coming out tonight and supporting this new collaboration. If you like the t-shirts, we have a couple of them for sale. There's a couple more that are not available here that will be available through the Rebel 8 website next week, I believe.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.